Jai Ma. So today we will take up a portion, maybe, you know, this longish chapter, and there are few chapters which are long and I don't want to rush through. So probably this chapter we'll do it in two classes. This is chapter 6 of the second part of the essays on the Gita. And it's titled Works, Devotion and Knowledge. We are still continuing with chapter 9 of the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. This is on page, just for reference, this is on page 322. So, what we have seen last time is the, if you may say, the idea or conception of the divine, because based on that the rest of the things will follow. For instance, if the divine is only the transcendent beyond and he has nothing to do with the cosmos or the individual, has no point of connection with it, then forever there will be a gulf between this world as we know it, experience it, and the transcendent divine. And somehow, some way, when we realize it, that's what is called as enlightenment. But the rest of the world labors on. Basically, one merges with the transcendent reality and there is no other reality. All this is only a temporary construct, a kind of system, a kind of pattern, but nothing with any substantial reality. We may call it whatever, Maya or anything else. And that's what we see is in Advaita school of Vedanta, that there is only one reality. Of course, there is another way of looking at Advaita, but that is Sri Aurobindo's way. But generally what is understood is this. Then there is another way that, well, the divine is within the individual as well as he is transcendent. So, purpose of the human soul is ultimately to figure out a way, as a river finds a way to reach the sea and merge into the sea. So we have two options. One is to live in this world of ignorance, and the second is to find the way out to the divine and become one with him. So this becomes Dvaita. So there are two realities. From one you can go into another. And then there are variations of that, Visishta Dvaita, that this has emerged from that but continues in ignorance, its life in ignorance, till it wakes up to the knowledge. So this, all this we have heard from many, many books and writers and authors. But then what of the cosmos? Does it have a meaning? Or is it just a splendid waste in which somehow human beings have come up after so many experiments that the divine or that reality has made, and ultimately one human consciousness has come up somehow, teeny weeny little one which has to merge back. So what about the cosmos? Is it simply a wasteful vanity? So this question remains unanswered. In traditional Vedanta, it remains unanswered, and really they don't even raise the question, because the whole idea is for the individual to find his door of escape. How does it matter about the rest? So this is these are the conceptions so far. Now Sri Aurobindo says, yes, there is a transcendent reality. Call it by whatever name, which is beyond the creation. And even we may say which is independent of the creation, and the creation depends on it, but it does not depend on the creation. So we have the idea of the author who is independent of the book or whatever he creates. We can even take the example of our own existence, that there is in us an existence which is not really dependent on the body, not really dependent on the thoughts, mind, feelings, passions, desires, anything at all, but it exists. But then at the next level, the second idea is that he is not only beyond the universe, beyond creation, but he has also, this entire creation is a means to express him for his play, as his expression, whatever we want to put it. And then comes this second aspect of the divine, which is the universal divine. So he is there in all the planes of existence, which are arranged hierarchically from the highest world to the lowest world. He is there in each of these planes of existence. And one can discover him, play with him. But this also doesn't give us a sense of the purpose of an individual in earthly life. Because if it's only cosmic or transcendent, then I don't have any other way of relating with this earthly life except the operating system which I have been given, which is ego and desire. I have to abolish it and find that reality. But how do I deal with people? Because there is no individual truth of my existence. And whatever I thought and felt is true is being told is a prison, is a barrier, it's distorted. So the third level at which the divine reality represents itself, formulates itself, expresses itself is the individual. So we have these three terms, which the Father, Son and the Holy Spirit, if you want to put it, the transcendent, the universal and the individual. And they are not exclusive of each other, they are coexistent. And that again we can take the example of our own existence. So I exist independent of all this, but if somebody says, where do you exist? It will be very difficult. You know, where do I exist? Yes, I am in my thoughts very much. What about feelings? I am there in my feelings. What about the will? I am there in my will. What about the brain? I am there in the brain. What about the heart? I am there in the pumping of the heart. What about the farthest finger or the toe? I am there in the toe also. Am I selectively present? No, I am there in all of this. But my consciousness arranges itself selectively by a process of concentration. I may be in the heart or the head, or if there is pain, I am in the toe. So all these things are simultaneously existing. So it's not like that divine is exclusive of this divine. So this is what we read last time. So then comes the logical next step, but this is not our experience. We don't experience anything beyond that little framework in which we are operating. So what are we supposed to do? So here we see the difference between one of the differences between religion and true spiritual life. Religion says, well, you have to accept it as a belief that there exists a God, there exists a reality. You have to take it as a belief. Why? Because X said so. End of the world. But yoga and spirituality say, no, no, no. You can start with taking that there is because X said so. But X also gives me a path by which I can discover and realize this truth in my own being. Because it's my own highest truth. So that is the difference between yoga and religion. That's why when it is said yoga is not a religion, it doesn't mean it is secular. That's a way of putting it. But it simply means yoga is the way through which all these religion is confined to beliefs. But yoga tells you that you need not just keep believing blindly, but you can realize what you believe in. So that's the yoga which is given. So then the third question is, if I can reclaim, discover my own lost portion, how do I do it? So there is a word in the Gita which Shubhendu stresses here. He says, sarva bhavena. By all means, by every which way, we can discover that reality. What does it mean? It means let's take stock of what is available with us. So what is available with us is thought. It's given to us. Whatever the degree of thought. What is available to us is a heart with feelings. What is available with us is will. So these are at least three definitely clear-cut psychological powers within us. In modern psychology, they are known as cognitive, affective, and conative. This is how even modern psychology, we see these three dimensions. So what do I do with these powers? They are the powers given which I can either invest in the temporary and transient things, or I can invest it with the discovery of the eternal within me. That's as simple as that. So what is meant by investing them? If instead of letting my thoughts run towards all the objects and pleasures of the world, I can turn it toward the divine reality, beyond, within, every, because the reality is everywhere, behind every mask. If I can turn my thoughts towards discovering this divine reality, which is hidden behind appearances, then I am engaging in the yoga of knowledge. And that thought may start with reading, but obviously knowledge becomes knowledge when I experience it as a reality. It's not enough to simply know about it. Then these feelings, instead of letting my feelings be invested in all kinds of temporary transient satisfactions, if I can turn these feelings toward the divine, I will be engaging in the yoga of love. And similarly with the will, if I invest my will to discover and fulfill the divine will within me and in the universe, then I am engaging in the yoga works. So there is a question which people often ask, that well, we are asked to surrender. So it's very difficult for the modern mind to surrender, because personal effort, I must put in the will. So they have a misconception about surrender. Well, surrender does not mean throwing your will out of the windows. That means becoming lazy. And a lazy person does no good either to himself or to the world. So surrender never means becoming lazy. Oh, God will do everything, now I have to do nothing. But it means that I have a little will, and this will is at my disposal, power of will, which I can use for 101 things. Now, if I surrender this will to the divine and I pray, aspire, that may this little will that I have be used by thee, thy will, to fulfill your purpose in the world. Not just my happiness, sorrow, but your purpose in the world. Then slowly, initially, it takes time, but a time comes when the divine takes it up. Say, okay, your will is, I take your will. So then he begins to tune our human will into the divine will, and this little human will, so there will be effort in it, but this effort will be in the direction that the divine intention is. So instead of turning this will into my purposes, I can turn it to divine purposes. The classic image is of Arjun sitting on the chariot. So whatever may be the differences and the similarities between Karna and Arjun, but this one factor makes a world of difference. Karna has displaced his capacities at the disposal of Duryodhana and his victory. Arjun has placed his capacities at the disposal of Krishna and his victory, whatever it be. So when we begin to do it, so he has to do the effort. Still he has to lift the bow. Still he has to put the arrow. Still he has to be skilled. Still he must be good in his work, sleepless. In fact, he should be even better, because if it is really the divine work that we want to do, we can't just have a laissez-faire attitude. We need to take it that, okay, now it's an important mission, impossible, original, part zero. So we have to completely surrender it so that the divine may work through it. So this is the basic thing about yoga. And then life begins. And it's that process is called a new birth. And there are several new births. And this whole chapter describes it with such a beautiful prosaic poetry. It's one of those chapters where one would love to read every line. Just to read it is a joy. So that's why I put it in two parts, because I don't want to rush through it. Something very beautiful when we read it, and he builds it like a music. Initially there are some basic notes, then it goes towards a crescendo, then it rises to a high peak. So it's amazing. Just let's take the joy of the chapter. Works, devotion and knowledge. This then is the integral truth, the highest and widest knowledge. Now you see, Sri Aurobindo's writing is so particular. He's not negating other forms of experiences. He's not saying that's not knowledge. He's saying this is the highest and widest. And logically, because it's all inclusive, a knowledge which excludes at one point even the one who is knowing cannot by its nature be the complete knowledge. So it's an inclusive knowledge, all comprehensive knowledge. So he says, the divine is supracosmic, the eternal Parabrahman who supports with his timeless and spaceless existence all this cosmic manifestation of his own being and nature in space and time. Honestly, if we read through this chapter, it can just the reading can give us a vision, some kind of a vision of the divine. It's written with such power. He is the supreme spirit who ensouls the forms and movements of the universe. Paramatman. So he is Parabrahman beyond all descriptions, definitions, but he is also Paramatman. So that which gives, makes things alive, the spirit in everything. He is the supernal person of whom all self and nature, all being and becoming in this or any universe are the self-conception and the self-energizing. Purushottama. So we have Parabrahman. He will also speak of Parameshwara, Purushottama. So all this is he, Paramatman. He is the ineffable Lord of all existence, who by his spiritual control of his own manifested power in nature, unrolls the cycles of the world and the natural evolution of creatures in the cycles, Parameshwara. So you see, now all these terms he's defining it for us. So Parabrahman, that of which nothing we can say, yet everything has come, is the source of everything. Then he is the Paramatman, the soul of souls, the self of self. And then he is the Parameshwara, the Lord of all creatures. And he is the Purushottama, the supreme person. From him the jiva. Now this about us. So we want to know, okay, fine, what about us? Who are we? From him the jiva, individual spirit, soul in nature. So this is the jiva, where he enters into nature and as an individual soul. Existent by his being, conscious by the light of his consciousness, empowered to knowledge, to will and to action by his will and power, enjoying existence by his divine enjoyment, all the cosmos has come here into the cosmic rounds. We are that, come from him as a portion of his being. All intelligence is a ray of his intelligence. So even logically we should turn it towards him in his service for his fulfillment in the world. And at the end, he says, he and you are one. That is the essence, essential truth. But to discover it, we have to first turn and join with him. So all that we have here, we are conscious by the light of his consciousness. I'm just replacing the word jiva by we. We are empowered to knowledge, to will and to action by his will and power. We are enjoying existence by his divine enjoyment of the cosmos. And that's how he has come here into the cosmic rounds. The inner soul in man is here a partial self-manifestation of the divine. This is our identity card is being distributed to us. We are all a partial self-manifestation of the divine. Changes all our understanding about it. This is a great responsibility if you look at it like that. And at another level, no responsibility, both together. Because we discover it, see who is operating in this world. But at the same time, just as for instance in the ashram, Sri Aurobindo says that each of you, especially speaks about people at the gate, you have a certain responsibility because people judge everything based on that first contact. So when people come to Auroville, you may show all the nice movies. It applies to ashram also. You may show a nice film, tell them all the goody-goody things, Auroville, and they are stunned, oh my God, this. But when they meet a person who is an Aurovillean and they interact, then If they say, oh, this is what your laboratory product is, this. So it gives, when we understand that we are ambassadors of the divine, his portions in the world, then it matters a lot, you know, how we are, how we live, how we express ourselves. We are a limited portion, self-limited for the works of his nature in the universe, Prakritir Jiva Bhuta. In his spiritual essence, the individual is one with the divine. In the works of the divine Prakriti, he is one with him. Yet there is an operative difference and many deep relations with God in nature and with God above cosmic nature. So what is the operative difference? Because people always say, oh, it's, you say you are God, can you build the cosmos? Now, this how people say, if you are God, well, first of all, God doesn't make it like, can I build the cosmos, and he creates it. But what it means is, see, people go to, now recently there was Kumbh and people got this water from Kumbh. And or Gangajal, many Hindus keep in their home Gangajal. So what does this Gangajal do? When you are dying, you put a tulsi leaf and you put Gangajal and you say, if you leave, you get moksha. Well, that's one part. So this Gangajal and that Gangajal, is there a difference? Essentially, no. But there is an operative difference. In that Gangajal, which is flowing with the Ganges, creatures thrive inside it. From crocodiles and whales and, not whales, sorry, but you know, nice fishes, tortoise, turtles. It can drown a whole city, or cities can spring at its, you know, command, because all the cities or the life has sprung around the, you know, the river banks. Its banks can, you know, support life. All this is that Gangajal can do. But this Gangajal, though in essence is the same, but there is an operative difference. This Gangajal can be used for the dead person, can be used for Kumbhavishekam, can be used for. So there is the individual jiva is a portion of the divine. If he connects with the divine, that power, that energy awakens in him. And the same thing that the divine wants to do can do through this jiva as an instrument, because essentially it's the same power, same knowledge. But if it doesn't join, it won't. For example, even this Gangajal, you are giving it in somebody's mouth. And the person is full of doubt, full of, you know, are, what will this do? This is just ordinary water. Then it doesn't become operative, because it's there. So similarly, we have to figure out a way that this little individual jiva can join with its source. Then it shares the glory and the greatness of the divine, but with an operative difference. That will always remain, because each jiva is a portion manifested for a certain work. And that's why it's so important to mind our own business. You are given this part, stay with that, fulfill God there, and don't get into all that is happening elsewhere. That's a different way divine is looking after. In the works of the lower appearance of Prakriti, see, he is using the word in the works of the lower appearance of Prakriti, he seems by an ignorance and egoistic separation to be quite other than the one, and to think, will, act, enjoy in this separative consciousness for the egoistic pleasure and purpose of his personal existence in the universe and its surface relations with other embodied minds and life. This is our normal state, ordinary state of humanity. But on page 323 we see, to get back to this truth of himself is his direct means of salvation. So if we, this, but because essentially it is one, it can discover and it should get back to that. His largest and nearest door of escape from subjection to the ignorance. Why nearest door? Because through the jiva, rather than going into the cosmic, divine and transcendent. This is the nearest, because it's right there within us. So that's why the mother and Sri Aurobindo insist on discovery of the psychic being. So that's why Sri Aurobindo says, the first, the mother says, is the divinity near you, most easily accessible, rather than going into that vastness. So first to discover the divine within, this is the nearest and yet the widest, because the moment we discover it, we can discover the universal divine and discover him everywhere. It is, so how do we do it? It is By turning all these powers, what are the powers? Since he is a spirit, a soul with a nature of mind and reason, of will and dynamic action, of emotion and sensation, and life seeking for the delight of existence, it is by turning all these powers Godwards that the return to the highest truth of himself can be made entirely possible. And because Shivindra's yoga directly takes from here, this part is completely one in sync with the Gita, the integral yoga from the triple path. And those who have practiced it are very deeply rooted in the yoga. What does it mean? It means, normally one thinks spiritual life means meditation. Meditation is only an activity of the mind, and that too only a small activity. Meditation can bring us in contact with a portion or an aspect of the divine, generally impersonal. But if we want the integral divine, Vasudevam Sarvamiti, then not only the mind but the heart has to engage, the will has to engage, all of them has to engage. It's not either or, that some are doing this, some are doing that. Every part of the being has to engage. So this is what Sri Aurobindo is revealing to us. It's also logical. Then he passes from the lower to the divine nature. He casts from him the thought and will and works of the ignorance, and thinks, wills and works in his divine identity as soul of that soul, as a divine delegate in humanity or a representative. Power and light of that spirit, he enjoys all the inner infinite of the divine, and no longer only these outward touches, masks and appearances. Thus divinely living, thus directing his whole self and soul and nature Godwards, he is taken up into the truest truth of the Supreme Brahman. So basically this is divine life in very simple word. First step is, all that is given to us is turned toward the divine. And then divine takes it up, and then he starts living, acting, thinking, feeling in us and through us. This is all that divine life is about. So this is what he beautifully says. To know Vasudeva is all and live in that knowledge is the secret. Okay. We'll just skip a page. Let me see. So as we begin to live this life, what happens? Therefore too his whole inner existence, page 324, comes into tune and harmony with the infinite, now self-revealed in all that lives or is within and around him, and his whole outer existence turns into an exact instrumentation of the cosmic purpose. But this requires a great degree of wideness, consciousness, plasticity and surrender. By the very fact that he is infinite. So infinite cannot be put into any slot of our finite mind. We cannot capture him in any system of philosophy, in any model of ethics or moral notions or ways of life, or systems, nothing, because he's infinite. The moment you say that I belong to this school of thought, that means you are still in thought, not with the divine. All schools of thought come from him, but none can capture him. So that's the whole thing, that when such a person is lifted up, automatically, see, people say to how to go beyond judgment, beyond condition. Buddha achieves it through so much effort to break the construction. This comes automatically in the yogin of the integral yoga, because he is in contact with the infinite. So he cannot be bound by any construct, whether his own, whether of the time, whether somebody was asking me today itself, there was a question that, sorry to say, but your generation, but not meaning me, your generation and this and that, and my generation and my generation. What do you feel? I said, I have never felt I belong to any generation. Because each generation has its own issues. So, but I agree that today's generation is better. That's honest statement. That it has less hypocrisy, it's more straightforward, more frank, and I just love today's generation, and they are going to become better and better. But having said that, I don't want to be bound by any generation, because by its nature, infinity is moving forward. So if at all you want to ask, I would say the future most generation, which is yet to come. So you can't be bound by anything. Some people are bound to the milieu in which they live, to the what they have grown up with, conditions, so many things. But touch of the infinite finishes it. You can't just help it. That's why it's called in Savitri as that which slays and saves. What is slays? Slays all that is finite, limited. And that's how it saves. Because only that which is infinite cannot die. All finite things will have an end. So this is where we, he says, and then he uses the word, he looks up through the self to the Parabrahman who there and here is the one and only existence. He looks up through the divine inhabitant in all to that supernal person who is his supreme status, is beyond all habitation in his supreme status. He looks up through the Lord manifested in the universe to the Supreme who exceeds and rules all his manifestation. Thus he arises through a limitless unfolding of knowledge and upward vision and aspiration to that to which he has turned with an all-compelling integrality, Sarvabhavin. This integral turning of the soul Godwards bases royally the Gita synthesis of knowledge and works and devotion. So this is the fundamental ground. Basically, everything in us should turn to the divine, to be taken up by the divine. There is a period of preparation or a giving. The divine does not immediately accept, because the sincerity is seen, taken up, whether he is really wanting or not. Of course he knows, but he waits for the right time, the right preparation. Because once he takes up, the whole world cannot snatch you away. This is a very mother's statement. She says, if you come to the divine and say, I am yours, and then she says, and the divine says yes, then the whole world cannot take you away, take you apart. So he waits, because after that you can't say, I am sorry, you know, I have duties to fulfill, I have issues to sort out, my this is waiting, my that is incomplete. You are finished. But once the divine takes up, then the whole real play begins. So that's what he is saying. So he says that this turning, what about, you know, he starts with, in most people, with a knowledge. And yet, even so, to know him is not enough unless it is accompanied by an intense uplifting of the heart and soul Godward. So this is very important. People keep on academic discussions and scholarly debates and books and comparisons. That is not the way to knowledge. Because to know truly, the whole being has to engage, because God is not just knowledge. He is also love. He is also a will operating in the cosmos. This beautiful passage in Savitri where death says to Savitri that you are too passionate heart and too much of love you speak. No, by knowing you shall cease to love. He says, if you know, you will stop all this love business and all this. And then Savitri says, when I have loved all, then I shall know. For I know that knowledge is a vast embrace. So God is not just an impersonal reality, but he is a living being, not just a consciousness, a power, but a heart of love. That heart of love is everywhere, in the universe, in us, in the creatures. And that makes yoga so beautiful and so delightful. Otherwise, all impersonal, impersonal, impersonal. So we are very... Unless, so this must kindle, otherwise it's useless. Any amount of book knowledge and juggling with words and mind is useless unless it kindles a one-pointed and at the same time all-embracing love adoration, aspiration. There is a beautiful aphorism of Sri Aurobindo. They say they love God, but they cannot love man. Whom are they in love with then? See, I mean, everything then becomes, because you disc, God is in all, logically. You can't say, I am a pakka ashramite, huh? You creature. The sign that you are, that you can embrace, and yet, just as the sign of that pure Ganga water is that its purity is never sullied. There is a very beautiful story of Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda. That time Vivekananda was not known as, he had never gone out. Narendra, and some people complained to him, you know about Narendra, you think very highly of him. They thought he doesn't know correctly, so they must inform him. You know, he goes to a hotel, sits there, even eats meat, perhaps takes wine also. So Sri Ramakrishna, with his usual style, he just brushes it, I say, you know, even if Narendra travelled outside, that time he is foreseen, and he sits with women, takes wine and eats meat, it will have no effect on him. He will have an effect on them. What a great... This is the Vedanta, that, you know, if you are unsullied, you are unsullied. Because that's the beauty of that power of the divine. It's infinite. Nothing can... See, finite things get... because there's finite, but infinite means constantly there is, every moment it's recreated, you know, washed away. So he says, all embracing love, adoration, aspiration. Indeed, the knowledge which is not companioned by an aspiration and vivified by an uplifting is no true knowledge. For it can be only an intellectual seeing and a barren cognitive endeavor. So he makes a distinction of Panditya and true knowledge. The vision of God brings infallibly the adoration and passionate seeking of the divine. A passion for the divine in his self-existent being, but also for the divine in ourselves and for the divine in all that is. To know with the intellect is simply to understand and may be an effective starting point. Or two, it may not be. And it will not be if there is no sincerity in the knowledge, no urge towards inner realization in the will, no power upon the soul, no call in the spirit. For that would mean that the brain has externally understood, but inwardly the soul has seen nothing. So this is the beautiful, very clear distinction. You may read all the books and know nothing about the eternal. So it's important to make that distinction, that you may sit for meditation and at the end declare it is an impersonal reality. That means you have not really known him. This is a poem of Sri Aurobindo on Krishna, where he says, vain lies space and time. They are hiding him. What is hidden behind the space and time and the impersonal? He says, red lips that kiss and blow the flute, hands that clasp. And then he defines, or rather says, about Sri Krishna. And I put it as, of course, same Sri Aurobindo and the mother. All he loves, all he moves, all are his, all are he. That is what true knowledge is. So this knowledge obviously leads to adoration and bhakti. So we have works, devotion and knowledge. So how all the three are interconnected, that's what Sri Aurobindo is describing to us. So when we know the divine is everywhere and in everything, what do we do? We invariably will not want to run away from anywhere to anywhere. This used to be one of my problems, that if God is here and he is working in the sewer, let us say, will I tell him, okay, bye-bye, I'm going, thank you for opening a berth for me in Nirvana? What kind of a love this is? One would say, rather, call me in. Let me also, my little teeny hands, join in clearing the sewer. Let me also drink a little bit of the poison that you are drinking. That's why Shubhendu says, who is the Superman who does it consciously? And then he says, why the serpents are dear to Shiva? Because they accepted to take the poison which he was drinking alone. All the gods, and they ran away. But Shiva loves them. At least they are, they have taken the poison and kept it inside. So this is how one proceeds. So works come from there. And then he says, well, it is, but to arrive at this movement at all is difficult for the ego-bound nature. Mortal mind is bewildered by its ignorant reliance upon veils and appearances. So we are, that's understood. We are constantly, it ignores the divinity, page 326, within itself and cannot see it in other men. And even though the divine manifests himself in humanity as avatar and vibhuti, it is still blind and ignores or despises the veil godhead. So often people tell me that, no, but God must tell me and he must, you know, what is he doing? I say, so many times he comes and tells, gives a scripture, gives all, but we are not ready even to follow that or even read it. I say, what do you mean God must... He comes as vibhutis, avatars, gives so many works, beautiful things. And then he says, even if you follow a little bit, swalpamasya dharmasya. And then we at the end complain, poor God, he has no choice, the buck stops there. So this is how it is. So now he makes a distinction between two types of humanity. And it's, God is in everyone, but it's important to understand the distinction. So that we need to convert ourselves from one type to the other. And it's important to understand that. So on page 326 he says that man, ego-bound man, does not see God in the universe. What it does see readily, and to that it attaches itself with passion, is only the life of the ego. So if you tell this to a people who are busy with partying and enjoying it, I am happy with my life. This is life. What is all this? Going to ashram. If you try to tell them it's real life, oh no, no, no. They don't understand. They feel you have gone a bit crazy. Of course, crazy, but in the better way. It's better to be thus crazy. So, he says, those who have given themselves up too entirely to this outward drive of the mentality fall into the hands of the lower nature, cling to it and make it their foundation. They become a prey to the nature of the Rakshasa. So this is the Rakshasa who is given only to the outward life entirely, almost entirely. All his efforts are directed towards gratifying the outward for pleasure, his own pleasure. Who sacrifices everything to a violent and inordinate satisfaction of his separate vital ego and makes that the dark godhead of his will and thought and action and enjoyment. So I know long time back there was a discussion going on and somebody said, no, in our religion it is said that, you know, all these things God has created for man's pleasure. I said, what a horrible God. He is. He created animals so that you put in your belly. He created the earth so that you can ransack all the resources. And then the next logical thing is he created us as the real child of God and all others to become our slaves. I said, this is how the mentality goes. But there are religions like that. This is Rakshasic thought. Or they are hurried toward onward. Now he makes a distinction between Rakshasa and the Asura. So who is the Rakshasa? He sacrifices everything to a violent and inordinate satisfaction of his separate vital ego. He will sacrifice his own natural capacities for pleasure. He will sacrifice, if necessary, his family for his personal enjoyment. He will sacrifice nation. He will sell everything for his personal gratification. That's what a Rakshasa is. What about the Asura? What does the Asura do? Or they are hurried onward in a fruitless cycle by the arrogant self-will. Asura is like, I know it all. I don't need to learn from anyone, anywhere. I have my free thought. I am educated from Harvard. Sorry. Now everybody is talking about it, so I can take it. I've been talking about it from 10 years. But I don't need to know. They get impressed only when they know Sri Aurobindo had studied in Cambridge. Then they say, oh. And then if you say he writes very good English, then they feel, ah, yes. A little bit they feel, okay, something of my match caliber. Sri Aurobindo knows the rules of the game. So the divine this time came, playing with the rules. You are impressed by this? Okay, done. So, self-regarding act, self-satisfied and yet ever unsatisfied, intellectualized appetite of enjoyment of the asuric nature. So asura is in the mind and the rakshasa is in the vital. But both are for the sake of the ego. A man who violently plunders life for his own enjoyment, doesn't care for anything and anyone, eats, devours literally everything. Because for him, his own appetite is what matters. He's a rakshasa. And asura, who is in the mind, he stands behind the rakshasa. He justifies, that's what urban naksals, now the term is. He justifies. He says, yes, that is the way of life. He uses all his intellectual mind at the service of the ego. And such a person, and of course he has his rakshasic appetites. But he has the rakshasic appetites plus the mind. He does it with a finish. He is the ambitious man who is going up the ladder, who doesn't mind nudging somebody and throwing him down and project himself that I am the only one your company needs. He is the man. So he is the asura. He'll have very impressive card. And all kinds of real and fake degrees will be written there. But we'll have no true knowledge. So, this is the asura. But then, fortunately, there are the great souled. Now he describes, this is the rakshasa and asura. But there are others who are great souled. That's what we should read. The great souled. So where does rakshasa and asura go? It's a labor of Sisyphus. So they keep on doing and at the end they discover nothing. The great souled, page 327, the great souled who open themselves to the light and largeness of the diviner nature of which man is capable. They want to upgrade, discover that highest reality, are alone on the path. Now he describes the path beautifully. Narrow in the beginning, inexpressibly wide in the end, that leads to liberation and perfection. See now the two lives. Life of the rakshasa is very wide. He is parting, he is going here, there, everywhere. He has all the contacts on his list, political, this, that. At the end, he has nobody by his side except the flatterers. And if he fails, everybody leaves him. You read the life of Kansa in his last days, or Aurangzeb. In his last days, he is doubting everybody around him. He's so suspicious. He is full of fear. That same thing happens with Kansa. He thinks Krishna has entered. Oh, where is he? Who is he? Somehow you must kill him because Krishna is growing upon him. So it's wide in the beginning. I am the Lord, ruler, and narrow in the end. But spiritual man is narrow in the beginning. I want to seek the divine. Doesn't matter. People may think he is crazy, mad. He doesn't come for parties. He is not. But in the end, he embraces God in everyone and everything. It's narrow in the beginning, but it becomes wide. Narrow in the beginning, inexpressibly wide in the end. That leads to liberation and perfection. So wide that in every creature, you can begin to feel the divine presence. And you can connect with the divine presence everywhere and in everything. The growth of the God in man is man's proper business. Imagine writing in our business card. In US they ask sometimes, not many, every once he asked me, why have you come? Because I had written, you know, visit for whatever, to deliver a lecture. So he said, business? I said, no. Because with business I understood that you have to take money. He said, why? Then I explained. He said, no, but that is business. I said, but I am not collecting any money. No, it is business. So I said, okay, I'll put business. So it doesn't matter. But I understand now what business means. So what is your business? Discovering God. Okay, have you met Dr. Alok Pandey, psychiatrist? Business. So he says it's our proper business. So behind whatever business we are doing, this should be our real business. Uses in the Life Divine also, the ascent to the divine life is the work of works, the soul acceptable sacrifice. It's what is our real business in this world. It's the only business which is the profitable to the end. Because you change your human nature with the divine nature. And it's carryover. No other business, even if you have earned everything, it's so. The growth of God, the God in man, is man's proper business. The steadfast turning of this lower asuric and rakshasic into the divine nature is the carefully hidden meaning of human life. How beautifully, carefully hidden. Why it is carefully hidden? Whatever we are seeking, joy, peace, power, knowledge, love, harmony, actually will only come if we discover the divine nature. So carefully hidden meaning of life. The eye opens to the Godhead in man, to the Godhead in the world. It sees inwardly and comes to know outwardly the infinite spirit, the imperishable from whom all existences originate, and who exists in all, and by him and him in him all exists. And this leads to a constant yoga. The last line on this passage: all life becomes a constant yoga and unification of the divine and this human spirit. So those who lay predominant stress on knowledge arrive to the same point. By an always increasing and grossing enforcing power of the vision of the divine on the soul and the nature. So this knowledge is not just knowledge of the essence, but in everything I want to discover the divine, let's say. Then there will be nothing else which I can exclude in the world. So this knowledge will lead to love and to service, if I really pursue it in all its wideness. And then he speaks about the way of works. The way of works too turns into an adoration and a devotion of self-giving, because it is an entire sacrifice of all our will and its activities to the one Purushottama. The outward Vedic rite is a powerful symbol, but the real sacrifice is that inner oblation in which the divine all becomes himself the ritual action, the sacrifice, and every single circumstance of the sacrifice. But keep this truth inside, because it disturbs people. So if somebody says, am I a distraction in your life? I said, no, you are part of the divine work. Oh, you mean you are doing service to the divine and all this is... It's very difficult to explain. Or people want, how do you like me? Well, divine is in you. No. Don't play that game. So divine in everybody expresses himself in some way or the other. And it's so beautiful to discover that. But that's not what our ego-bound humanity wants. So it's better to keep these secrets inside. But he's revealing it in all-engrossing discovery of the divine. It's so beautiful. You discover people in their divine essence, in the expression. Everybody has something or the other of the divine quality expressed, maybe in outward action, maybe in thought, feeling, and that we can become a point to enter. See, this is what he says. Okay, I'll go a few lines above because he puts it so powerfully. It is a heartfelt seeking and seizing of the Supreme and the Universal, a pursuit of the infinite in his infinity and of the infinite in all that is finite, a vision and embracing of the One in his oneness and of the One in all his several principles, his innumerable visages, forces, forms, here, there, everywhere, timelessly and in time, multiply, multitudinously, in endless aspects of his Godhead, in beings without number. All his million universal faces, fronting us in the world and its creatures. How beautiful this vision is. So many ways one discovers. There is a beautiful line which I often remember, one of the poet who sings it, he says, in Bengali, Amar eke Krishna mon bhore na ami onek Krishna duve chai. I am not happy with one Krishna, I want many Krishnas all around. So this is where we are led, and he speaks about the inner sacrifice which goes on continuously. He says, Vedic sacrifice, that outer, you have a ritual fire and put oblation, that's okay. He says, it's powerful. He's not denying it again. But the real sacrifice is when there is an inner sacrifice going on, an inner oblation, every thought, feeling, sensation, everything is being offered into that, to the divine Godhead. So how beautiful life would be, he is showing us. And with this, we'll stop. It's again very powerful. All these are meditations. So often, if you read these passages or take out these passages, and we can use it as meditation because they are very powerful. See, on page 329, with which we will stop. The illumining Godhead is himself the Veda and that which is made known by the Veda. He is both the knowledge and the object of the knowledge. The Rig, the Yajur, the Sam, the word of illumination which lights up the mind with the rays of knowledge. That's why Sri Krishna says that he who has discovered the infinite, for him the four Vedas are nothing, but it's like the importance is like a person who is in the ocean has a bottle full of water. Because he's surrounded by that. All the Vedas are singing his glory. That's why when people say that, you know, which mantra, I said, can there be anything more powerful than the divine name? All the Vedas are singing his glory. And when he, the glory of glories, is already there. So do you still want to say, I'm going to recite a verse of the Veda? He said, hold on, I'll go back, you recite, I'll come back after you have recited. So that's what he's saying. He's the Yajur. Yajur is sacrifice. Sam, the bhakti, the song, the Rig, the knowledge. All this is he. The Rig, the Yajur, the Sam, the word of illumination which lights up the mind with the rays of knowledge. The word of power for the right ordaining of action. The word of calm and harmonious attainment for the bringing of the divine desire of the spirit are themselves the Brahman, the Godhead. She is the aspiration, she is the beginning, she is the prayer, she is the goal towards which it climbs. And it's so logical even to understand, though there is no need to use the logic. Where does it come from? How does it come from? What gives it the energizing power to climb upward? All this is none else but the Divine Mother. The mantra of the Divine Consciousness brings its light of revelation. The mantra of the Divine Power, its will of effectuation. The mantra of the divine Ananda, its equal fulfillment of the spiritual delight of existence. And since Sri Aurobindo is writing it in the context of the Gita, where it speaks of Om as the symbol of that mantra, he says, all word and thought are an outflowering of the great Om. Om, the word, the eternal, manifest in the forms of sensible objects, manifest in that conscious play of creative self-conception of which forms and objects are the figures. So forms and objects are that. And all that they reveal, they reflect, they symbolize, they express. Each object holds within itself a meaning of God, thought of God in creation. The sea, its vastness, the sky, its vastness. The earth, its forbearance, everything. So it expresses itself in the form and is the spirit and the idea behind the form. So all that is Om. It first conceives, like everything, no? We conceive and then we express. So there is a divine conception of creation. And creation is meant to express that. So it expresses through the language of forms. Manifest behind in the self-gathered superconscient power of the infinite. Om is the sovereign soul, seed, womb of thing, an idea, form and name. It is itself, integrally, the supreme, intangible, the original unity, the timeless mystery, self-existent above all manifestation in supernal being. This sacrifice is therefore at once works and adoration and knowledge. So one cannot take up yoga without the mother's grace. She calls to the path. She is the origin. She is the path, becomes the path, because she gives us the strength to walk through the path. And she is the goal of the journey. This is a small little letter of Sri Aurobindo. The mother is the path and the mother is the goal. If you know this, all else is wonderful. Jai Ma.